This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to Saturday AM. I'm Linda Mottram. Today on the program, could Australia's strict external border controls be in breach of international law?
This is really about protecting the civil and human rights of people. And I think most Aussies are under the impression that they could just leave the country if they had to, and we can't.
And an immigrant nation with no immigrants, can our economy recover without them?
We have industries and employers calling out, pleading, in fact, for workers. And migrants come to Australia and they fill those much-needed positions.
Our borders have been closed for nearly 5 months now. The controls are some of the strictest in the world, and they've helped protect us from the huge outbreaks of COVID-19 that have ripped through parts of Europe and the Americas. But with one in three Australians born overseas, they've also separated families. Erica Jeffroy is a dual British-Australian national. She and her brother both live here and have been trying to get their mum out from the UK.
So my brother needs a kidney transplant. He's been on dialysis now for just a couple of months. But when we found out he was going to be on dialysis and needing that, I started the process of becoming a live kidney donor. And we needed our mum to come out here to help us with recovery. But also I have two small children who are 3 and 6. And I need her to come out and help me with managing to run a home, but also support me and my brother emotionally through this whole process.
So you applied to have your mother come here from the UK. Her exemption was denied. Do you know why?
You get a pretty generic email, and the response was, your circumstances do not meet the requirements for referral to the commissioner or delegate. That was the only response we had. She applied on compassionate and compelling grounds, but there actually is no definition for what is a compassionate and compelling ground. When my mum spoke to the Australian Embassy in London, they said there's no appeals process. You just have to keep going through the process again and again and again and again.
And just to be clear, this is because the federal government, the Australian government, has very strict controls on travel in and out of Australia. And so you're being denied under that process that enables some exemptions, but you don't know what the basis for the exemption is.
That's correct. Yeah. And the frustrating part of it as well is obviously the compelling and compassionate part, but also immediate family members. So parents are not considered immediate family members under the COVID-19 exemptions. However, if you were to apply for a visa in the normal world, they are considered to be immediate family. How a parent cannot be classed as immediate family is beyond me, and how this cannot be seen as compelling and compassionate reasoning is again, I have no idea why it wouldn't be classed as that.
So have you tried reapplying?
We haven't yet. When we received the rejection, we had a discussion with the family and also the transplant team, and we've had to actually put off the surgery because she is unable to come.
So what does that mean for your brother's health?
I mean, he is on dialysis, but 23% of people who are on dialysis die whilst they're doing dialysis. And whilst that might seem like a small number, when that's your family member, it's shocking and it's really hard. And the frustrating part of this is I'm ready to go. I'm here. I'm willing to give my kidney and I just can't because we can't get my mum here.
You've seen other people have their exemptions approved. Does it feel like there's no rational process here?
It seems to be, from what I can see, whoever gets your application on the day can make the decision for you. The fact that ours was completely denied, it wasn't even able to get to the commissioner, is baffling to me. I don't understand it. And my story is no better or worse than anyone else's, but I don't understand the rationale behind denying this when you're allowing movie stars to come into Australia to film movies. They get their exemptions, they do their quarantine to come here and film a movie, but my mum can't come to help me through, me and my brother through a massive medical procedure. I don't understand.
British-Australian citizen Erica Jeffroy. What's more unusual about Australia's border closures is that they stop people from leaving as well as coming in. You can only get out if you have an exemption from the government on compelling or compassionate grounds. The Australian Border Force says that between the 25th of March and the end of July, more than 22,600 Australians and permanent residents were given exemptions to depart Australia. But some Australians feel like they're being held in the country against their will.
It's been almost all year now that my children haven't seen their brothers. I haven't seen my stepsons. My husband and I have seen each other once. And we're just one of many, many thousands of families that are stuck.
Christina Williams has been trying to get out of Australia to see her husband, who's based in the United States.
Look, hard doesn't even sum it up. It's been honestly heartbreaking because it's a mystery. You know, we apply, there's people applying that have dying loved ones overseas. There are people that are missing out on births of people, of children, of deaths, of, you know, funerals, education, employment. I think there's a real misconception that it's all about tourism or travellers that were caught abroad and were too lazy to get back. There's a lot of us in this country, we're a multicultural nation, that live across borders. And the application process has got people experiencing rejection after rejection.
How many times have you applied and been rejected?
Look, I applied 5 times. My husband applied about another 5 or 6 times. We were rejected over and over again with no reason given. You know, they say apply under compassionate grounds. And when you apply and you submit photos of your children, your reports by your psychiatrist, you show the emotional economic impact and then it's declined, you just think, what do I need to show? It's not border closures that keep us safe, it's quarantine. And if we're willing to quarantine upon return and pay for it, I would love somebody to tell me why we can't reunite families.
You do have an exemption to travel now after trying all those times. Does that solve your problem?
You know, it's kind of like having a prisoner in a prison cell and saying you can go out for a walk today and then in you go back tomorrow. Yes, we were granted an exemption after our 5th attempt or, you know, 11th attempt if you join them both up. And it was after appearing on a television program and it was given no reason once again why that same day we were approved. But, you know, I think about my family. Okay, once we've seen each other for 1 week, what happens next? This vaccine is not something that's going to happen tomorrow. We don't even know if it'll work. You know, we're frustrated because it's not just us, but thousands of families, and there seems to be no plan B.
You said, you know, the issue that you think is protecting us is quarantine rather than border closures, but a lot of Australians feel very strongly that border closures are really important. Do you sympathise with their view?
I'm, like everybody, really glad that the borders were shut initially. You know, we supported the move. We thought it was the right thing to do. But just like we have to find a way to reopen pubs and restaurants and education, we have to look at safe ways to reopen the international borders because, as I said, this is really about protecting the liberty, the civil and human rights of people. We can't just indefinitely have them closed. Australia's international country, we need to look at solutions. The government has issued no plan, no concept, and meanwhile, we're alone in the world in this policy. Other countries have figured it out. Why aren't we doing something to look for solutions here?
Christina Williams there. Now, a spokesperson for Home Affairs Minister Peter Dutton said the decision to grant travel exemptions must be balanced against the government's intent for imposing the travel ban and the health risks posed to the Australian community by international travellers. It says each case is unique and is considered on its merits. But we're no closer to knowing exactly how that process happens. Well, Dr. Kate Ogg is an expert in human rights law at ANU. She says the policy may be in breach of international law.
Well, I think the strongest argument they have is that the travel bans are in violation of the right to leave in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Now, Australia ratified that human rights treaty in 1980. So from an international law perspective, it is legally bound by the rights in that treaty. And anyone in Australian territory or subject to its jurisdiction can claim these rights. So just to step you through it a little bit, Article 12 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, often abbreviated to the ICCPR, is about freedom of movement. And one aspect of freedom of movement is the right to leave any country, including a person's own country. Now, it's not an absolute right. The government can place restrictions on that right, and these restrictions must be necessary to protect a number of objectives, and one of them is public health. So if you looked at the phase, if you just look at the text of the ICCPR, Article 12 in the ICCPR, you may think, well, Australia isn't in breach because, yes, it's restricted the right to leave, but it's done so to protect public health. But if you look at the UN Human Rights Committee, so that's the body that is charged with supervising the implementation of the ICCPR, it is said that the restrictions must be the least intrusive method available which could achieve the desired result. And this is why I think there is a strong argument that the Australian travel ban, so not allowing citizens and permanent residents to leave, is in breach. Now, I don't think there's any doubt that these restrictions have been put in place to protect public health, to protect the health of the Australian community, and protect also the health of the people in the overseas destinations where an Australian who might be infected with COVID-19 may wish to travel to. But this travel ban, which is subject to only a very few exceptions, I don't think it's the least intrusive method to achieve this very legitimate public health concern. There are other less intrusive options, for example, allowing citizens and permanent residents to leave and then when they return, requiring them to quarantine. But also what the government could do is that it could require citizens and permanent residents to be tested before departing and only allowing those people who have a negative test to leave the country.
How does this policy in Australia compare to other wealthy countries around the world? Have others gone as far as Australia has in banning their own citizens effectively from leaving as well as coming in?
Not as far as I'm aware. I'm not aware of any other high-income country banning its citizens from leaving. I'm aware that for at least a time, for example, Kazakhstan, Lithuania had a similar ban in place. I would suspect the reason why other countries in a comparable situation to Australia haven't got a similar ban, I mean, one reason is because it would just, in practical terms, be very difficult to do so. So let's think of the Canada-US land border. It is the longest undefended land border in the world. It would be very, very difficult for either the US or Canada to ban its citizens or permanent residents from crossing that border. But of course, a good comparator to Australia is New Zealand. It's an island nation similar to Australia. It's quite geographically isolated, and it's not a transit country in the sense that Singapore or the UK is a transit country. Now, New Zealand has not banned its citizens from leaving. It has urged them not to undertake international travel, which I think is very wise, and that is certainly the New Zealand government's role to urge its citizens not to travel, to warn them of the dangers of international travel, but it hasn't placed a ban on international travel in the way the Australian government has.
Now, Australia does not have a Bill of Rights. Would it have been able to impose these restrictions on travel if it did have a Bill of Rights?
Okay, so it's first important to recognise that Australia does have some human rights protection. For example, we've got some human rights in our constitution. We have a Federal Sex Discrimination Act, Racial Discrimination Act, and we've got human rights acts in Victoria, the ACT, and now Queensland. But this right, the right to leave, is not protected in domestic law in Australia. Now, if this right was protected in, let's say, a constitutional Bill of Rights, if we had one, the government could certainly impose the travel ban, but the ban could then be challenged in our courts, with the High Court of Australia having the final say as to whether that ban was inconsistent with the right to leave, noting, of course, it's not an absolute right. Now, if Australia, let's say, protected the right to leave not in a constitutional Bill of Rights, but in, let's say, a Federal Human Rights Act, then again, the government could impose the travel ban. It could then be subject to litigation, so we could challenge that in our courts. But then if the government didn't like the court's decision, it could then simply amend the legislation. So human rights are always better protected in a constitutional Bill of Rights than in legislation.
So is there any way, as it stands, for people to challenge these restrictions on leaving and coming back in under existing law?
It would be very, very difficult to challenge the ban on the grounds that it is a breach of the right to leave, especially the right to leave in the ICCPR in our domestic court system. Now, Australian courts will hear international law arguments, but only if they can be grounded in domestic legislation in some way. Now, saying that, there are some cases where lawyers have come up with very, very creative ways of litigating what are essentially violations of international human rights law, but finding a domestic common law hook to do so. And I think the most recent example we've seen of that is what has been dubbed the Medivac litigation in the Federal Court of Australia. So this is litigation where lawyers have been trying to help their clients in asylum seekers and refugees in Nauru and Manus Island try to get out. And they haven't been able to plead international law arguments. But what instead they've done is they've based the cases in tort law, which is domestic common law. So there is a chance for some very creative lawyering here where lawyers can think of a domestic law argument based in common law or legislation to argue that the travel ban is in violation of rights, and I hope they do. It would be an interesting case to watch, but it would be very difficult to directly argue that they're in violation of the ICCPR. I think that that argument would not succeed.
Kate Ogg, thank you very much for your expertise today.
Thank you very much for your time.
So what's this doing to our mental health? Well, Emmy Golding is a psychologist and she's the founder of the Workplace Mental Health Institute. She's been helping clients who are struggling with the isolation.
Fear, stress, anxiety, depression. I'm seeing the whole range of things. So we've got students who are not sure if they can return to study, they're stressed about whether they're going to fall behind their peers and what that's going to mean for their future career prospects. Got people who I work with who have lost family members and haven't been able to return back home to see, to attend funeral and be with extended family at that point in time. So obviously it's incredibly distressing for people, and I'm seeing, you know, we're getting so many more calls for people asking for help than we ever have before. So it's a really difficult situation for so many Australians.
Yeah, well, one in three Australians is born overseas. So that's a lot of people potentially in this boat, not being able to get home to see family and friends. Do the border closures affect the rest of us too, even if it's just a case of not being able to plan our next holiday?
Absolutely. And not being able to plan your next holiday sounds trivial in comparison to some of the other situations that people are facing, but it's really not, because from a psychological perspective, it's about my ability to set goals, to be in charge of my life, that sense of control that is so important for us as human beings, for our psychological health. So when we don't have control over our life, we get this sense of helplessness. And then when we don't know how long that's going to last for, with all the uncertainty, when are the restrictions going to be lifted, then we get hopelessness. So it's not just the family member connection. It's also being able to plan and be in charge. That freedom is such a core sort of human value for so many people.
And this virus, of course, is with us potentially for years. That's a long-term problem we're facing, isn't it?
Exactly. And we don't seem to have long-term strategies as a society as to how we're going to handle that. We know that, we can pull together for a short period of time as individuals and as groups, but when it's sustained, this sustained level of stress and anxiety and uncertainty and tension is really, it doesn't bode well for mental health at all.
So you say that part of the difficulty is about a lack of control.
Yes.
What course of action can we take in the face of a lack of control that's mandated by a disease and the state?
Well, at an individual level, it's about planning what we can. How do we regaining that sense of control by saying, you know, I might have had this sort of list of objectives for 2020 or ideas on what I wanted to do this year. And now that looks like it's not going to be possible, at least not in the way that I had originally planned. So how can I rethink this and still achieve what I wanted in a different way? Or what else can I do instead so that I can still get this sense of progression, of moving forward with things? because we know that, you know, it's important for us as humans to have goals to be able to move forward. So it's getting the right balance between being kind to yourself if you don't achieve everything that you wanted to, but also moving forward where you can.
And you're talking to me from Spain, so
are
you living this experience yourself?
Yes, absolutely. I was over here for business in Europe earlier this year. It was meant to be a couple of months, and when everything happened, we made the call to stay put and went through the lockdown in Spain, which was one of the strictest in the world. It was very, very challenging. And while I was in Spain talking with people in Australia at that point, they didn't have quite the same level of restriction. So they said, oh, we're in lockdown too. And I thought, well, not quite the same. And now it's reversed in a lot of ways. So I'm very careful when I'm talking with friends who are in Victoria in particular, but also some of the other hotspots as well, not to make it too uncomfortable for them, because we are in a slightly easier situation at the moment here.
Emmy Golding, thank you for speaking with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
With the borders closed, there's been a dramatic downturn in immigration. The government says that net migration will fall to about 34,000 people this year. That's compared to the pre-COVID cap of 160,000. What does that mean for our economy? Well, Liz Allen is a demographer at the ANU.
So if we look at our demographic profile in terms of our age composition, the reality is that we have more people retiring from the workforce than people entering the workforce. And with that, we have industries and employers calling out, pleading, in fact, for workers. And migrants come to Australia and they fill those much-needed positions. Now, in terms of what the effective closed borders will mean for Australia, a number of industries will be affected. If we look at one of our major exports, education, we're going to have to learn to do things differently if we want to continue meeting the demand, but also encouraging the supply side of that industry.
And on the student issue, I mean, that's a big part of the story too, isn't it? Because we don't just have overseas students coming here and, you know, being the cash cow for our universities. A lot of those students are trained here and then they stay here and work here, correct?
Indeed, our education market, for want of a better phrase, is a pretty vital component of our economy, not just in terms of students, but also, as you've mentioned, migrants who come to Australia and complete degrees will often stay on or return to Australia later on. And we've been talking about a figure concerning permanent migrant program and its reduction. But migration to Australia is more than just that permanent scheme. It extends to a more broader scheme that includes temporary migrants as well. And so that entire suite of immigration, overseas immigration to Australia, will be impacted. We're going to see our entire economy suffer ripple effects of the effectively closed borders.
Do you have any sense of how significant that effect might be in, I guess, you know, percentage or dollar terms?
It's hard to quantify because there are so many uncertainties around when things will return to normal, how things might ever return, if they do ever return to normal. The other thing that I'm really pleased about is that we're seeing a great deal of innovation occurring. And I see that as well reflected in the kind of safe passage schemes of particular groups, say, for example, the people working in fruit picking and the like, coming from particular areas and being housed in safe quarantine circumstances. So we're getting good at adjusting and making good of our new normal. And so I think that it won't be as disastrous as I think we first suspected, but I suspect that the impacts will last longer than we first anticipated.
And not only do we have, you know, those numbers of people not coming in and the ageing population, but we also, the government has also flagged that birth rates are likely to fall because of weaker economic conditions. Do you foresee that as well?
I certainly do. When we first had lockdown, I think there were many that suspected that perhaps we might see a boom. We're indoors. What better thing to do than to get cozy with the partner? But we don't have the necessary ingredients for a baby boom. The other thing too is we probably don't want a boom right now. Having a boom means greater pressure and demands on vital and essential infrastructure and services.
So is there the potential here, if we don't get it right, for a sort of self-fulfilling demographic crisis? Fewer immigrants begets fewer Australians, and round we go, lower and lower population and a corroding economy. Is that possible?
The headline figure of the population size of Australia, that's not the concern here. Neither is the growth rate from my perspective as a demographer. Rather, the concern is the age distribution, the composition, what the population is comprised of. But in particular, that big chunk in the middle, the economic lifeline of the nation, those people in the working age ranges and the people in the workforce. At the moment, we know that we're in for a bit of strife, and it's only going to get worse. But at the same time, we've got serious inequalities, and the inequalities among younger workers are increasing and becoming more entrenched. And these are things that we need to consider as well. We have the opportunity to reprioritise spending. And my concern is that we need to get that spending right so that our demographic profile is the right composition for the nation, and more importantly, to fund our essential and vital infrastructure and services.
I'm interested a bit in sort of the character of Australia in this situation too, or coming out of this situation. What does this all mean for us as an open immigrant society? Can we learn anything perhaps from history about whether we'll emerge from this one looking like we did before?
Australia likes to think that we are among the best, if not the best, multicultural nation in the world. But current behaviours and rate of abuse towards people that look something other than the white majority signals that we have an enduring problem with what it means to be Australian. And all it took was a crisis to make us even more uncomfortable with ourselves and turn effectively on ourselves, hurling abuse at people on the street that might appear to be from Asian backgrounds. We're turning on ourselves, and we're harming ourselves in the long run. We're making the nation appear to be unwelcoming. We are being unwelcoming, and that will hurt us in the long run.
Some people say this is an opportunity to rethink or reset our immigration policy. Labor's Shadow Home Affairs Minister Christina Keneally just a few weeks ago has written that a lazy dependence on temporary migrants, the students, the working holiday makers, that stifled wage growth and kept Australians out of jobs. If you do let those migrants back when we open the borders, isn't there a very real consideration about unemployment for the population that's here?
Of course, whenever we consider immigration and migrant intake, we need to consider the needs of the local population. The reality is, though, at the moment, migrants aren't taking locals' jobs. And in fact, migrants help boost the economy and help create jobs. That said, we need a population strategy, really, to consider the full range and suite of policy issues in totality, rather than kind of disparate puzzle pieces that are scattered across the table. We need to bring those back in, reconnect them, and refocus in on what's needed for the future of our population. And that includes a more coherent education and training program for young people. But we also need to consider the elements within our taxation system that favour older workers and wealthier people. And so we're seeing younger people copping it hard, and they're the future of us. They're who we're looking toward to get us out of this mess, and more importantly, to be the future of the nation. And we're not looking after them. And the data shows that migrants are helping support the young workforce, And more importantly, if we look at the attitudes among younger people, they actually show that younger people are more supportive of migration than older people. So it's, I don't believe that young people see migrants as competition, but rather as a support mechanism.
Demographer Liz Allen. Well, that's Saturday AM for this week. Find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. And there's news every 15 minutes over at ABC News Radio. I'm Linda Mottram. Talk to you next Saturday.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.